The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I'm going to say this right now. This is the single prettiest place I have ever done a interview from. We are live at Ripon Hill on Lake Wanaka in South Island, New Zealand. I am here with the winemaker. I am here with Nick Mills, who is quietly trying to pour himself some tea.
Yeah.
Because we went for a really... Actually, a nice swim. Not, it was not cold. Well, it wasn't warm. It was certainly cold. But Nick, first
thing... There was more of a dip. It was more of a dip, to be clear.
So, yeah, that wasn't your normal morning swim, was
yeah.
it?
No. That's just getting the body temperature down and feeling good for the start of the day.
Well, first off, thank you so much for doing this. And before, like, I have all the questions and everything I want to ask you, I kind of want to start here. What was today all about? We had a huddle, and it was one of the last days for a lot of the crew. What is today like for you and for Ripon?
What's today like? It's one like any other, really. It starts with a swim and, as we just said, just taking the temperature down and having a moment of reflection and feeling part of this place and... Just being part of the lake just feels so really good. And feel, then we'd normally come up and we'd have huddle, and we did that and look each other in the eye. Often the next thing we do is go out hand hoeing, and that's like connecting manually with the land every morning, which feels really good. It's a real non-hierarchical sort of thing to do. You sweat a bit, you get a bit, exercise your back, and then everyone goes off and does their own thing. That's kind of, so it's pretty much any normal day, but right now, last day of the season, it's... Yeah, again, reflecting on that, at huddle this morning was lovely. It's, back in start of November, you're just faced with this massive amount of work that's ahead of you and feels a little bit daunting. But at the end, it's like, the quality of viticulture out there is just extraordinary. We're just walking around this morning talking about the last little moves we're going to do, and it just looks amazing right now.
November must feel like the start of a marathon. The start of a marathon is always the hardest because you realize I got 42 kilometers. But there's no better feeling than when you can see the finish line. And this is still not the finish line. You've still a lot of time with the sun. But
yeah.
there must be just such a contrast between how you felt in November versus how we all felt an hour ago.
Yeah, strangely, it kind of feels the same, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it does. I thinking about my emotions and stuff this morning was, I don't know, it's such a cycle. There's cycles and they're moving the whole time. But at the same time, we try not to... Me personally, anyway, I try not to invest too much emotionally in the ups and downs of the season. Mm-hmm. And I guess that goes to the start and the finish as well. Like, if you sort of think, oh, this is amazing now, then there's always going to be this isn't so amazing now, So it might be a slightly boring way of living life, but it's really just trying to stay constant and observe what you see and observe the weather and observe what's happening in the ground and observing what's happening with the team and actually just feel good about it or just observe it and keep on moving. So, yeah, I don't really try not to get super excited. Sometimes it happens anyway, but just try and get a nice, really metered rhythm throughout the year.
And that was also just nice, sweet. Like, everyone comes, you get in a circle, everyone shakes everyone's hand.
Yeah.
Like, that just a very... Like, just being a part of it felt like a very nice sense of community here.
Yeah, especially when a couple of blonde twins turn up and start giving cuddles and everyone, the energy goes up pretty straight away.
Yeah. Amy and Christy, who were part of the last podcast I did in Tasmania, Kate Hill. Yeah, one of your staff members hugged Amy and then was shocked when hugged Christy. He's like, wait, there's another one of you here?
It was a beautiful moment.
It was fun. Mm. What was life like for you in the early 90s when you first started working in wine? I mean, it must be such a contrast to now in 2026.
Personally?
Yeah.
Was it the early 90s? I guess it must have been. I think I started working in the vineyard it was definitely in the 80s when I started working in the vineyard. It was our school holiday job when we were kids growing up. And at that stage for me, it was just what our parents were doing. It wasn't cool or it was just, it's just what you do. Is that you think that's what your family? It's completely normalized. I guess it was in the late 80s, early 90s, where I figured out through the help of Rudy Bauer, actually, who was working here at the time, who's our winemaker in the vineyard, and it was just sort of, oh, this could actually be more than just, what you're bred into or what your family's doing. It's sort of started to see that it was something that could be of interest to me and nourishing personally for a long period of my life. And so it was at that stage, it was just, I want to say, going through the motions. I was learning, mm-hmm. which I am still now, but it's different. Now it's a lot more engagement, and I mean, it's a different type of work now as well. But early 90s, I guess, where it was also counterculture as well was going on, you know, Generation X and all of that, where it was important to try and express yourself as, I mean, or try and find ways of doing new things and feeling like a rebel and all of that. So maybe that was going on back in those days as well.
How far back does your family go with this land? Like, how far back are they tied into where we are?
I guess we found some letters of our great-grandfathers who came here in the late 1800s and sort of found out about this wondrous and faraway land, as he wrote to his father in his letters. But he bought Wanaka Station, our farm, in 1912. So we've been here for, 114 years this year. Yeah, he went to the Brigato Lectures in 1895, which was, I don't know if you've talked about the Brigato Lectures in your podcast.
Have not yet.
Yeah, it was an Italian-Croatian viticulturalist, I believe, that was paid by the New Zealand government, actually by the Victorian government in Australia first, to go around the country looking for viticultural potential. And then he came here in 1895 and went around the country doing the same, paid by the New Zealand government. And he declared that viticulture was potential for, there was a potential for Burgundian-style varieties to flourish here. Our great-grandfather Percy was at those lectures, and they were in 1895 at the Dunedin Chamber of Commerce. And but no one acted on those, including him. But yeah, so that's what, four going on five generations now.
Wow. So I mean, this land must mean so much to you. I know you've walked around every nook and cranny. You've swam around every shoreline, around every island, around every buoy. I mean, you must have, even today, just like wandering around, this must be such a special connection because it goes back hundreds of years to your family.
Yeah, I mean, there's that. You also have to acknowledge that it sounds like a long time, perhaps certainly in this town, but it's not really that long. There are histories and stories here that were here before us. Wanaka, its name means place of education or workshop. And Māori used to come up here and use this place as a soft inland camp where they'd teach their kids hunting and fishing, gathering, genealogy, survival, essentially, in this environment. And so those stories we acknowledge, and we acknowledge, obviously, you have to own all of your stories, the good and the bad, and certainly we're here because of colonialism and because of the Wastelands Act in 1855 and the Treaty in 1840 rather. All of those things have shaped how our relationship is with this land, but there's lots of other things that we need to acknowledge in that space as well.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
1998, Nagano Olympics. How close were you to having a very different life than the one now? I read that a serious injury back then might have changed the trajectory of Nick Mills, the winemaker, to maybe a different version of yourself.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would have made a different version of myself.
Or maybe a later version.
A later version, or changed it. I'm still that same person, I think, that I was before my life redirected. What happened was, I'd been training to get to the Olympics in 98 for like 5 years, and I was New Zealand champion for at least one of those, and you know, number one seed on our World Cup slots for a couple of seasons as well, and that's what I was trying to get to, Nagano. And yeah, I don't know, I chance accident, blew my knee in a downhill race. It was like 5 months, 4 or 5 months before the Olympics, so that sort of changed me immediately in that space. But it only pivoted me towards the other half of my life more strongly, which was viticulture and farming and having attachment to this piece of land. So I think it was all, in hindsight, I didn't know it at the time, but I was probably always going to fall back on that. Mm-hmm. Not so much necessarily the wine part, it was just me and my sisters grew up on this land and we fell in love with it, and it was always an intention to maintain that connection, and I guess if we were in love with the land, try and help it find its potential and learn, teach ourselves how to look after it better. And so that's what we were doing anyway, and that's certainly what I redirected to. Got there eventually.
We'll get to the Ripon wine portfolio.
You can say Ripon if you like.
I've been saying it wrong. Like I've been saying Ripon before Ripon. The amount of different ways I said Lake Wanaka,
Wanaka.
The amount of different ways I've screwed it up before we got here. We drilled down. Like, no, you can't say it wrong once you get to the vineyard.
Oh, look, it's like we used to have a concert here. Mm-hmm. We were always Ripon. Ripon, and that sounds like Yorkshire. You know, our family probably for Anglo-Saxon descent, possibly north, you know, Yorkshire. So, and there's a Ripon up there with one P, and they all call it Ripon. The people where Ripon comes from is more like the concert, I think. For me, anyway, it sounded like when we had this concert for 20 years here, are you going to Ripon this year? And so it almost it changed there. I personally don't have a preference. People can call it what they want. We say Ripon, but, you know, whatever.
That's good because, by the way, I'll find a third way to say the name and screw it up. People need to know this property. If anyone who's in Lake Wanaka, they need to come to Ripon because this beautiful almost amphitheater that you guys used to have concerts. It's a gorgeous site. Mm-hmm. Before we get to the portfolio, would you consider yourself more of a farmer or more of a winemaker, or is it 50-50?
Well, consider myself far less of a winemaker than anything else. If you rephrase the question and said, am I a wine grower or a farmer?
Okay,
I would have to weigh that up. But a winemaker, yeah, if you have to point a finger at someone on the property and say, who's the winemaker in English, you'd probably point it at me. I have a lovely assistant winemaker, Kelly, up in the winery who spends more time in the winery than I do, outside of harvest, that is. But wine, we don't really look at the craft as something that we make. It's something that it's a guiding process. You know, the winemakers do exist. It's when you have it's an artistic sort of realm where you take a palette of different blends and you make a wine to a preconceived idea of what you want. That's winemaking, and it's a creative process, but it's not what we do here. So ours is it's growing a soil, it's nurturing living tissue out of that into Vinus vinifera, into something that has reproductive organs, which we take at the time that they were going to drop anyway, and put it through a natural secondary process, a guiding process, whereby we don't have any intellectual blends. It's all geographic blends. So it's and we get it through its process and into an inert recipient, into an inert vessel that we can then sell and pass on. So it's not really artistic, it's a craft, yes, and there is maybe a little bit of art and part of it, but it's not a making or a creational process for me anyway. So yeah, I don't consider myself a winemaker. That I learnt my craft in France, and that word doesn't even exist. In fact, now it's vinificateur, you know, they had to translate winemaker back into French. But at the origin, it's a vigneron or viticulteur. There's no understanding of winemaking in those words. So we feel that's kind of who we are. In terms of farming, yeah, I feel that Ripon is a living farm, and I have a relationship with that farm. And so in that instance, yeah, I'm a farmer. But, farming also, to some degree, sounds like how you dress or how you identify or something like that. It's just simply that Ripon is a living farm, a living entity, and our family maintain a relationship with it. So we're farmers in that sense as well.
What do people need to know? We'll start with the whites. Certainly more on the aromatic sides, the Gewurz, the Rieslings, the Osteiner, and I'm sure I mispronounced that.
Osteiner, yeah.
Osteiner, yeah. There's an Einer in near the end of that. When someone asks you about your white wines, how would you describe your white portfolio?
Tactile, textural, tonic, digestive, something that's for the body, not just the face. And you use the word aromatics, but aromatics describe, I think, a style of wine or a set of varieties that issue certain smells and flavors in certain ways that make them feel aromatic. For me, I'm much less drawn to that side of the wine. That's kind of a given anyway with Riesling and certainly Gewurz as well. But what I prefer to, you know, see wine as is something that's for the body. It's interesting from the smells and flavors, but for me, wine is much more about how it feels and how it makes you feel. And so we definitely favor
a production system within the whites that accentuate that. So much more about breaking down the amino acids of the yeast through autolysis into glutamates, into something that's going to be tactile and salivaceous, and you know, something that's going to be digestive as well.
By the way, I love salivaceous.
That's a great word.
I have not heard that word before. That's fantastic. Yeah.
It's hard to say when you're salivating. It's a very hard word to say. It's delicious.
Yeah.
When you say delicious, when you've got a mouthful of salivaceous wine or tonic wine, it becomes very difficult to say.
Well, as we've discovered, there's a lot of words that are difficult to say. And then on the reds, I mean, it's a wide variety. We tried from the young vines to two other your Pinots we didn't get to try, but I know you also have like more of a Beaujolais style. What for you does a good glass of Ripon Pinot taste like?
Well, I'd rather you answer that question, because taste is something that is very subjective.
Okay, I want to have a go on this one.
But because it's a really interesting question. It's subjective, and it's also ephemeral. Flavors and smells, they move and they move around, whereas shape and feel is much more immutable and consistent from bottle to bottle and time over time as well. So back to this, what does a really great bottle of Ripon feel like? It feels like much like the environment it's in. It's clear, it's clean, it's next to a large body of water in Wanaka. It's a very it's soft inland camp where you want to bring up your kids, so you don't get a lot of flesh, you don't get a lot of climatic mass in the wines. It's a much more temperate place, so these are like more mountain wines that are about precision, detail, articulation of tannin. Any power is compressed power and driven forward rather than opulent or voluminous sort of power. It's much more about that articulation of and detail, I get, is what we get here.
I want to read.
Did that answer the question?
No, you did. You did. Well, I guess the other one asks, and this is more for people that are just discovering New Zealand.
Mm.
And again, this is going to go. I'm always nervous because this is about generalizations. If someone is going to have a glass of well-made Wanaka Pinot versus a glass of well-made Central Otago Pinot, so just an hour south from here.
Yeah.
Is there any markers people can look for to differentiate, or is it just too much about vintage or the people in charge?
No, it's, I mean, right from where we're sitting, we can see the glaciers of the main divide just up in the V there. They're sort of slightly obscured by some clouds, but we're the closest to the main divide, which is, the Partage des Eaux, the space, but the line that separates east from west is right in front of us. And there's 5 to 10 meters of rainfalls on those mountains right there. And the further you go down the valley, it's going to get drier. It's also going to get hotter. It's also going to get colder in the evenings. So we get more continental the further we get away from that line, from that main divide. We are the closest to that, so we're not as hot or as cold or as dry as the rest of the region, which means that we don't really, you know, diurnal range creates a fruit mass and quality and clarity and volume as well. So we don't have a lot of, our wines can't be described as being sleek or mobile or generous or warm and giving, all of those beautiful attributes that we have further down the valley and here in Central Otago. Up here, because of our proximity to divide, again, we're much more about precision, detail, mm-hmm. articulation of tannin. And so there is a marked difference for sure.
I saw this quote. These are scary, exciting times for winos. For better or worse, growing wine for us feels like the only way to stay here. But is that worth maintaining for us, for our family, for the wine drinker? Do the customers benefit from this? I wonder sometimes if people see it as worth paying for. I found that Nick Mills quote, and I'm wondering if you could expand on it in the context of it.
Yeah, that's me, I guess, on a reflecting on farm succession and the cost of doing business I grew up and did my studies in Burgundy and it's a place where viticulture has over time proven itself as, you know, allowing the land to express itself to its potential over time. That's to say, it can hold off any other craft or any other way of working that land, and that's over hundreds of years that it's done that. And over the last, I guess, 40, 50 years that we've been growing grapes here, the whole goal is to, our whole activity as farmers, in the way that our dad grew up, and he grew up with his grandparents and his grandmother, and their whole mojo was to try and understand the potential of this land for any type of culture, in being light on the feet and moving towards that space so the land can express itself to its potential. But it could have been any. At any potential. We were goat farmers, we had mixed crops, we had horses, we had, you know, all sorts of different other ideas that could have possibly worked here. And Dad moved it through, and viticulture and Pinot Noir floated to the surface through that process. The way that we've done that, and the way that we maintain our interaction and our connection to this land, is it costs money. It costs time. And the way that we've worked, we've been organic since the inception, we've been unirrigated and biodynamic since 2002. And we've been doing it in a town that was as we were growing up, was a high country, a service town to high country farmers. So my mother immediately had to start exporting the wine or taking the wine somewhere else. It couldn't be sold locally. No one really understood. There were no restaurants here. There were no cafes. We had to go to the cities. We had to go to the major metropolitan areas around the world to sell to people that could not only get why we were working in that way, but then were prepared and able, had the means to buy it at the price that we needed to demand to create that business model. And so that's always a question for me, and that's what I think you were what you've read there is that. Do people actually care? Will they care enough? Because we need them to care for this type of business model to work. It's always a reflection: is this the right way to go? You know, and I'll keep thinking that. I have to keep thinking that. It's an ongoing question that I have in my head.
But it brings you more joy than stress.
Yeah, it does. In balance of things, it does. Yeah. It sounds. I don't know. People say, "Oh, the responsibility." Ask me about if there's a responsibility and it's weighty, and you know, fourth generation on the farm and trying to look after it and for future generations of the land and trying to maintain our family's sense of belonging, connection to this land, which isn't evident either as the family grows, and some of them didn't grow up here, and all sorts of other beautiful complexities within that we deal with as a family. But it doesn't really feel like a weight. It feels like roots coming out the bottom of your feet, and it gets sort of a sense of immobility. Like if something happens, like COVID or whatever it is, you can't. You know, that fantastic word was pivot or reimagine, and all of those stuff and that things. We can't. If someone pushes you, you can't take a step back because you've got roots growing out the bottom of your feet. So you just like sort of you have to flex in a different way. It's not like it's a weight. It's a permanence, a sense of permanence you've just been there a long time, and you've established a certain set of norms and cultural mores and things that connect you and that have worked, and it's robust, but it's also connected so strongly that your flexal point is quite difficult sometimes, or it's challenging.
You're kind of like a tree sometimes with a heavy wind.
Exactly.
You're swaying
That's
back
what it
and
feels
forth.
Like. Like that, rather than like sitting under a rock or something that you're trying to hold up.
Yeah.
It's like,
and you're not like Sisyphus.
No.
And yeah, by the way, I hated pivot. I hated that during COVID. Oh, we're going to pivot. All that vernacular just
It seemed important when we were right in the middle of it because things were changing so fast. But at the end of it, after all of the questioning, and we did a lot of questioning and navel gazing like everyone did, at the end of the day, it was just like double down. Mm-hmm. We believe in who we are and the values that we've established over time, and we just have to stick with them. And we have to, again, hope that, you know, work that people can see the value in paying the money that they need to pay to make this business model work. There's no, you would have seen, there's no one driving any flash cars here. You know, all land, all of the... Anything that we make goes straight back into the land and the people that are working it. So
I should, I should tell anyone, especially people listening in Toronto, if you're at the LCBO and you see a bottle of wine from Wanaka, and Ripon wines are there, $80, $100, whatever it is well worth it. I mean, just in terms of biodynamic, organic, paying the staff well. Everything is hand-picked. Everything is low yield. And I can tell...
It's like, all here, too.
What's
like
that?
We don't buy any fruit. Mm-hmm. Anything you see is from this one singular place.
Yeah.
These are the oldest vines in the region, on their own roots, unirrigated, biodynamically farmed, no adjustments and must, selected for the site, three decades of massage selection. You know, that costs money.
Yeah.
All of that. It costs time and money. And, mm-hmm. it, and it's worth paying for because it increases detail and articulation.
And all I would say to anyone, take a $20 mass-produced Pinot, put it up against this, and you will tell right away. I mean, even your wines, not even an entry level, the young vines. I mean, that wine was beautiful, and it was rich and just this dark fruit. And then we tried one of the higher-end single vineyards, and Amy and Chris and I were all sitting there, and we all made the noise. And the noise is a simple one. It's just a, oh, and that's all it is. And I think in some ways, that to me is the best compliment you can give to a winery is when you just go, oh, because you're surprised by it, almost like the noise I made when I went in the water this morning. You know, but and that's the thing is you can tell the quality of the wines here.
I think it's detail, it's identity, it's consistency. And you were talking about the Gewürz before, and if you look at, no matter what the variety is, if you line them up, especially when you get to taste them at the cellar door, or sometimes, you know, I'm working around trade and visiting sommeliers or trade people around the world, and of course you get to taste seven or eight wines in a row all from the same place, and even though they all have slightly different textural markers and you know, varietal shifts, you can feel the sense of the place is really the strongest voice across all of the wines. Again, precision, detail, articulation of tannin, power through compression and drive over opulence and mass. You can say that about the Gewürz, the Riesling, every single one of the Pinots. That is the identity of Ripon and the identity of this place.
I do like power through compression versus opulence, because those are two completely different wines. Going back for a second, and I'll ask you a couple more questions, then we'll end this, because I know you're super busy, and
it's okay.
And it's been a chilly morning. What was, I think, was it around 2003 when you and your wife, when you guys sort of took over for your parents? And I'm just wondering, I might have the year wrong, but I'm wondering, what was that like when you guys sort of had more of the responsibility of the day-to-day?
So how did it happen? I came home in October 2002, and my brother was still already here, Bones, driving the tractors. My sister Charlie came back. She'd studied viticulture in Roseworthy in Australia. My sister Sarah, who's a chef, came back, was here already, and came into the vineyard, working in the vineyard as well around that time. My wife Jo came in, I think, 2005, 2006. And so by 2006, it was me and my wife and my mum and my two sisters and my sisters and my brother and about four full-time staff. And we stayed like that for about 15 years working in that sort of capacity. And it was beautiful. It was absolutely amazing. It was, you know, there's challenges and difficulties, but mainly it was just gorgeous. And of course, you know, COVID, the pivoting and all of that was personal, and you know, so it changed things up, and you know, everyone had to reevaluate their life needs and what was important to them, and so things have changed in the last few years in terms of who's in and who's adjacent, but it still feels to me and to the people here really strongly family related, and family, like, it's still the number one word that comes to people's mind when they think about Ripon, and there's good reason for that. How did it feel when we came home and took the reins? Well, not a huge amount of difference. I mean, Dad died in 2000, 2 years before I came home. So he never saw that sort of next, that successionary shift, that generational shift, sadly, in the management at least. As I say, Bones, my brother, was already home by that stage. But I don't know, the first thing I said when I came home was like, Mum, we need to build a compost platform, you know. We need to move from organics into biodynamics. And it wasn't really a shift. She's like, well, of course we do, you know. There wasn't a massive shift in, there was really no shift in mentality and or ideology in that sense. We were already working in that way. Ripon for us was already a singular farm unit with which we maintained a relationship. So we already had that farm individuality idea within us. And so it was a very, very, I don't think much has changed, to be honest, in that space. In terms of our work, in terms of our relationship with the land, has pretty much stayed intact and consistent through that time.
I think family is the perfect way to describe this. A lot of families, they can't keep a business going. The succession plans, infighting, it happens throughout life. And you guys have certainly seemed to be able to navigate a lot of the minefields of that. And again, hanging out in the huddle, just that sense of family as well. As we end this, anything you just want to, like, people that don't know much about New Zealand or South Island or this area, anything else they need to know about either this land or this winery if they're thinking of making the flight. It's a long one. It's Toronto to San Fran to, you know, to Auckland, or sometimes maybe you can get down to Queenstown. It's a hell of a flight. I think it's worth it. But what's anything else people need to know?
Probably, yeah, just sort of the way that you've just introduced that question makes me think about the tyranny of distance. And that's a split end song. It's a line anyway. And what it says to me is that it's a massive part of our identity as New Zealanders is being sitting down here in the middle of the big blue. You know, a third of the whole planet is the Pacific Ocean, and the largest body of water on the planet, and we're sitting right in the middle of it, and we're isolated within those islands as well, down in the south in the mountains, and that's a massive part of our identity, and we're really proud of that, and it really forms who we are, and often who the wines are as well. But it's also so it's something that we're proud of, and something, you know, our political naivety that we can exercise in these troubling times, where we can allow ourselves to escape it for better or for worse as well. At the same time, there's a harder side to that, and that's that distance and the lack of connection with our people as wine growers. You know, my colleagues in France, anyone can get a train 2 hours, they're there, you know, and they can have those conversations, the ones like we're having now. But you, as you've said, you've had to come all the way out here, so we don't often get you guys like you coming and visiting us. And so we're doing our thing, and we're in our own spaces, and we're running our lives, and it's only when we can get out. So I guess the point is behind that is a wine transcends that. Wine, we put our piece of our place and our heart and our spirit and our land, the voice of our land, into an inert vessel, and we can ship it around, and that can be opened up without having to cook or change it, and you can put that straight into your bloodstream, across your palate, and through your digestive system, and that is communing with this beautiful piece of land on the other side of the planet. That's one way of doing it, and please do it if you ever see it, and you'll hear us in there, you'll feel us in there, and you'll feel our land. But really, if you can come here, and you can you know, take the carbon on the nose and come and plant some trees with us down here and feel good about that, then coming and visiting us, and we've got a beautiful cellar door and a beautiful event space, and we love seeing people, and when they do it, and you understand the place much more accurately, and you see what it is, and yeah, you can connect with us more intimately that way.
And one last little tip, anyone out there, if you're thinking of getting married on this vineyard, better book it for 2032. They're pretty booked up until then. Nick, really appreciate this. I love the story of your family, of this land, of your wines. They're beautiful, and just appreciate you taking time to be a part of the podcast.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to have you down here. And again, that you come to me is the most special thing that can be done, because it's so much harder for us to go out there and visit everyone else. Thank you.
I appreciated the swim. I appreciated the huddle.
Good one.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, on iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.